them, but I believe they were trying to make the innovation in terms of implementing impedance matching and impedance transforming attenuation. So, just for you to look at the pictures, if you go to that US 7961064, and then you have a B2. 7961064B2. And this publication type is ground. So, it's interesting. And to actually.
From your first reading of that patent, Wes, what is the invention? In order for there to be invention, you have to pass three gates. One, it's got to be useful. Two, it's got to be new. And I forget what the third one is. Something that hasn't been done before. So what is unique about this invention?
The best way to find out is reading the claims. In the first claim, they have a pair of coupled transmission line. It says pair of transmission line being located in the close proximity to each other. So they are electromagnetically coupled to each other. Well, that's nothing new. Said the pair of the coupled transmission line comprising the first transmission line and the second transmission line. Said first transmission line comprising its first end to which first RF port is connected, and the second end to which second RF port is connected. Said second transmission line comprising a first end to which the third RF port is connected. So then the electrical signal feed to said first RF port produced a direct electrical signal, and said second RF port and the coupled RF signal and said third RF port, said part, said pair of the of coupled transmission line having an even mode impedance Z0E and an odd mode impedance Z0O and 2XGN.
KC2QIQ with the credit.
Yeah, so far every one of those claims you read is nothing unique. That is the description of a directional coupler. So I haven't heard anything unique yet that makes that a invention yet. Let's see what Glenn's got to say. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, I bet you've used directional couplers.
Yeah, what a two drinking. This is a couple too. But yeah, I just wanted to point out for anybody that's interested in actually looking at a structure that's a directional coupler on eBay, there's a listing for a high quality sensor coupler board for VSWR and power meter measurements from 10 megahertz to 3 gigahertz. And you can buy this board where you can solder on your own surface mount diodes and your own little surface mount resistors and make the coupler with the diode that you were talking about before. And right now the board is going for $8. It doesn't look like an extremely broadband version, but it looks like you could practically size this with the resistor and everything to anywhere between 10 meg to 3 gig, which is kind of interesting, which is the same frequency range that John, the detector diode, the HP detector diode that John was talking about before, is basically the same range. KC2QIQ.
Out of curiosity, Glenn, what is the highest frequency and or lowest frequency you have ever used, designed, or touched, or was familiar with a directional coupler? What's the highest and lowest frequency you've ever used one of those at? Go ahead, John. I mean, Glenn.
100 kilohertz, and the high end is probably 22 gigahertz stick.
That's a lot of octaves. I think I once used one at the 24 gigs. Not very far from you. That was the lowest I've ever used one. I've used one at 1 megahertz. That's something that I patented. I made a kind of directional coupler with 60 decibels of directivity with synchronous demodulation at 1 megahertz, but that's another whole story. So these very simple devices, properly used, can do some awful nice magic. Really nice magic. To make a synchronous demodulator, on a Wienbridge-like directional coupler can give you the equivalent of a room through of filters where this thing, because of the synchronous demodulation, let me drop. Because of synchronous demodulation, this thing would pass a 1 megahertz signal plus or minus 20 kilohertz, and that's all. 20 kilohertz of bandwidth, 1 megacycle center frequency, absolutely no response to any other frequency because it was a synchronous demodulator. A very simple circuit of a couple of resistors, a couple of capacitors, a couple of operational amplifiers. You try to do that, what I just described, with real filtering. That sharp a filter with no re-entrances from 0 to 1,000 megs. Oh boy, you fill up a room with filters almost. And just by using synchronous demodulation on a Wienbridge kind of directional coupler, all of that fill out with very simple circuitry. We're talking about $10 worth of hardware, if you know what I mean. And there's a reason why I needed that. I needed very high sensitivity at that one frequency and absolutely no other frequency. And synchronous demodulation can do that. That's another whole story we got to get into someday. Because the vast majority of ham radio operators, let me drop, and the vast majority of good electronic RF engineers have heard the word synchronous demodulation. They get a vague feeling for what it is. It can do magic very inexpensively. And to do it by any other means, it'd be pulling out your hair. I wonder if you've ever used synchronous demodulation. I'm sure you have, but by way of all of the, let me think now. What's the word for it? I know that you built a whole lot of power supply inverter circuits and also these power supply quality modulators, quality, what is that called now? Those circuits that make sure that you've got a good power factor. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Power factor correctors, and you can add to that RF amplifiers, directional couplers, dual directional couplers, and power combiners and dividers. Pin diode circuitry, phase array, UHF radar. I've covered X-ray, X-ray detection, diagnostic circuits. I've covered quite a broad range of things there, Dick. But synchronous rectification. Synchronous. I'm not sure that, by definition, if I've truly used that. I'm sure I've used things that were similar to it, but not, by definition, the way that you just described it. KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the word I was using was synchronous demodulation. One of the things that was done at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, where a very, very sensitive tail warning radar system to be installed in the B-1B bomber had to have very high sensitivity, and it was a range Doppler matrix airborne pulse Doppler radar. That's a fancy way of saying that this radar had a zillion equivalent filters which could look at every possible Doppler shifted frequency of the radar echoes. When you build a radar with that kind of hardware, oh, it's got sensitivity like you wouldn't believe. The receiver on that thing, I believe, could easily demodulate a signal at minus 145 dBm. In other words, for each one of those filters in that range Doppler matrix, it had probably a noise equivalent bandwidth of a kilohertz or less on this radar that's running, you know, a zillion pulses per second at a lot of high power. Let me drop it. The good news is that the radar had super sensitivity with all of these Doppler filters, that whether the echo came back with a high positive Doppler shift, a high negative Doppler shift, and a whole lot of resolution of it, this thing could read that. That's the good news. The bad news is the thing had to be fed with a switching modulated power supply, a switching power supply. The switching power supply is making spikes up the kazoo. And no matter how much you filter, you can knock down those spikes, 30 dB, 40 dB, 60 dB, 80 dB, to really make sure that the power supply on this high power radar, switching power supply, didn't create phony responses. You would have had to filter that power supply by 160 dB. Out of the question. It's a very crafty thing they did. was to look at the pulse rep rate of the radar, make sure that it was very precisely harmonically related to the switching rate of the power supply. Therefore, the power supply was making its spikes, but the spikes were not drifting through the periods of reception of the radar. You had locked them into the dead zone of the radar, if you know what I mean. You arranged it in such a way that the spike coming out of the power supply only occurred the instant that the transmitter was transmitting. And when it flipped over to the receive mode, the power supply had finished making its spike and it was all over. By carefully synchronizing that, they had the sensitivity they wanted and they could live with all the spikes coming out of that switching regulator. I wonder if you've ever worked on a circuit like that, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, actually, I had to do quite a few circuits like that. Both Raytheon, they had a lot of, Royal Netherlands Navy had a bunch of things that were like that as well, where we basically synchronized the oscillator. We had basically, it was kind of like a sharing port. In other words, you could either use the oscillator signal as the master or the slave. So basically, you could take this signal and use it as a clock, or if you wanted to overdrive it to a higher frequency. In other words, we would basically start the reference oscillator at somewhere like around 75 kilohertz, but the circuit could work to near 200. So basically, what they would do is either use our 75 kilohertz base signal, or what they would do is basically send in a shorter pulse and then reset the oscillator to a higher frequency. And used for radar. It was also, there were a lot of video circuits that used that as well, because if they wanted to keep video trace clean so that you wouldn't have any phantom signals in the video signal, they would also clock it at the same rate as the power supply. KC2QIQ.
You may have heard the story of what happened at this major computing center in New York City. Oh, I'm guessing this is way back in 1970 or so, 75. Word processing programs were just starting to become very popular. So you had this great big sea of women doing word processing on word processing computers. And there was in the basement of that building a Con Ed transformer making some real strong magnetic fields. The magnetic fields coupled into the cathode ray tubes of the word processors were making all the words on the screen dance, and it was hard to read the words. And so various people said, well, we'll just change that transformer to one that's better shielded. Well, that transformer was powering a huge building, and we're talking about a many megawatt transformer, buried below ground into a vault below the building of this multi-story building in Manhattan. Let me drop it. And to change that transformer almost would have taken an act of Congress and $1 zillion. And various people tried to talk Con Ed into doing that. And he said, hey, the transformer is meeting the spec. It meets OSHA, NIOSH, and all the other, and the ANSI specs. We're not going to change that. No, we'll change it if you're willing to give us X number of megabucks. The final answer was to go out and buy another computer program to do word processing where the screen was synchronized to a harmonic of 60 hertz. So although the magnetic field was creating a slight deflection of things on the screen, as long as nothing moved, as long as it didn't dance, everybody could tolerate it. That was the final answer. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff, Dick. Is my signal still coming through the repeater?
Loud and clear.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting that there were a lot of things before multi-syncing and the monitors came through and everything where they were really susceptible to a lot of problems. And there were a lot of the earlier military displays that, especially with 400 hertz, boy, the amount of problems that they used to have. And synchronization techniques were used all over. But I know that the video is really improved over the years, and those kinds of things really aren't issues anymore. Back to you, the K2RW, KC2QIQ.
anybody can screw up. To really make a mistake requires a computer. Okay, we're getting near the end. I go over to you. Go ahead, Wes. Wes? Go ahead, Wes. Give us a brief rundown on what you're involved in these days.
Don't forget Paul. And his out here.
My goodness, we completely forgot about Paul. Wow. Hey, Paul. Give us a... Boy, what a... We went way left of center here tonight. We bragged about the fact that we're not organized. We're not regimented. WS2N, K2RW, go ahead, Paul.
I don't care. I was involved listening to directional coupling stories. Very interesting. I think I just wanted to go over a couple of the problems that the American Space Program had in the last week.
Did anything exciting happen this week at Wallops Island? I thought it was a nice, calm show. Paul, I'm having some fun with you. Go ahead, Paul. Tell us the latest on all of that.
The desert story, too. Oh, I didn't hear what John said.
Don't forget the story of the desert crash.
I know it. That's what I mean. A couple of big problems this past week. In fact, on Monday I was waiting for the launch of the Cygnus Antares rocket, and got down to 12 minutes, and it was around, it was like a 6:45 launch, and they called a halt, and this was one of these things that people were going to go outside and look, including me. I had a spot all lined up, so I looked at the computer, and ready to go, and then they called her off because there was a boat floating around in the downrange southeast of the direction this thing was going to go. I mean, that's common to clear the traffic out. I mean, I've never heard of any flight being delayed because of that, but in this case it was. Some sailboat was out there. And so then they came back for another launch the next Tuesday night. And that was for 6:22. And sure enough, 9 seconds after launch, what I was doing, I was watching the computer. I saw the thing take off. And I've seen many of the Antares flights take off. So I think I'm not going to miss anything on the computer. Let me go outside and find my spot. Sure enough, there's no light, there's no nothing, and I found out that it exploded. So that was the story and my personal story. But Cygnus was loaded with almost 5,000 pounds of stuff. They had an upgraded motor attached to the Cygnus spacecraft, and it didn't make it. And it looks like it was the engine. Probably the engine, main engine, on the first stage that let go. Caused a lot of damage, and nobody got hurt, which was a good thing. That was one disaster.
Let me ask you a quick question on this one, Paul. It is my belief that whenever you scrap a mission on the first day, and you wait 24 hours and then try to launch on the second day, and you get all these cryogenic fuel sitting on there for another 24 hours, gathering ice. In the case of Challenger, that created a lot of grief. In the case of Columbia, that created a lot of grief. If I was an astronaut and I know I'm going on the second day, I know I'd be a lot less comfortable. Is there any chance that you know of that the ice buildup and the extra 24 hours was an aggravating factor for the Antares failure? WS2N, K2LAW.
No, I don't think so. They've had so many cancellations with the Antares, just like a lot of the rockets. Plenty of scrubs, 2-3 different scrubs, and they come back and they've taken off. This would have been their third paid mission up to the space station. It would have been their fourth docking with the space station. They had two previous launches before that. One with a mass simulator attached, duplicating the Cygnus spacecraft. Early on, that was one of the early flights. And then they had the docking an unpaid one. They bought up like 800 pounds of stuff. Now they had these last three missions, but this one didn't work out. I think I'm going to take a wild guess here, but it's probably the AJ-26-62 rocket, the engines that they're using. These were initially Russian-made. At that time, they were called the NK-33s. Orbital has been using these things. They bought them up years ago and have them stored in a warehouse. And, they reworked them. They put new gimbals on, electronics. And they put them into operation. Put two of them on each Antares rocket and let her rip. They've had problems. I mean, these are old engines. Not only are they old designs, these are physically decades old, you know, probably from the 60s to 1970s. Sure, they, upgrade them, they rework them and all, but they're basically old engines that, of course, were never used before. The old Russian engines. So, I'd like to see them get away from that. There's plans of doing that. Not for many years down the road. I know what they had a problem back in May 22nd, actually. In fact, I talked about this on the net. They take all of these engines and they test fire them before they send them to be put onto an Antares rocket. And they had one blow up on the 22nd of May this year. It literally blew up on the stand down in Mississippi, Stennis, Mississippi, where they test these rockets for NASA, destroy their whole setup that they use to test the rockets. So that thing blew up, and now this one blew up. You know, there's a lot of corrosive effect that goes on with these things. I'm going to go with the engine. Now, these are not to be confused with the other rocket engines, the RD-180s. That are also Russian engines that were later models. These have completely different ones. These are decades older than the RD-180s. The RD-180s, also Russian rockets that are installed on the Atlas rockets, and that's not by Orbital, that's by United Launch Alliance, which is really a combination of Lockheed and Boeing. They're the ones that were really in the news recently, being cut off by the Russians. These other ones we've had in storage, so we have plenty of them. Starting to think that they're no good. So there's plans by Orbital to eventually go on with different engines. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen. There's different rockets that we use in the United States. We use the Delta II, Delta IV. The Delta II uses, they call it an RS-27A, and that's all American made. RP-1, that means kerosene type liquid fuel. And then you got the bigger one, the Delta IV. That's going up this December, and that's called the Delta IV Heavy. Essentially, it's three Delta rockets that they put together. They use two of them as booster rockets. And they're completely different. That's the one that's going to be launching the Orion spacecraft on its first test mission coming this December. And that's not a kerosene-based rocket. It's all liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Very similar to the SSME, the space shuttle main engines, the RS-25s that, of course, are reusable. And these are RS-68s with the Delta IV hydrogen fuel rockets are not reusable. They're expendable. But they're much simpler to make than the shuttle ones. proven technology, and again, American made. So we only have really two that we're dealing with in the States that are problematic, I think, because of the Russians, the RD-180s, which they haven't had any problems with. That's being launched by the Atlas rockets. It's been taking up military flights. It took up the X-37B a couple of years ago, and no problem with the Atlas rockets. And then you have the other ones, these HA-26s, or the Antares rocket. AJ stands for Aerojet. Aerojet is the ones that rebuild these things for orbital science. So that's pretty much the story on that. You've got the Falcon 9, which is completely different, set up, all 100% made by SpaceX. So it's really the only ones I'm concerned about are the Antares and, of course, eventually the Atlas. But the Atlas has plans. Within probably 3 or 4 years of having completely different engines for the Atlas. And they made a deal recently with Blue Origin, which is going to be developing, or they have been developing for the last 3 years now, something called the BE-4, and that will replace these RD-170s, Russian built for the Atlas rockets. And that's all liquid methane, another completely different design. And of course, all these rockets are using liquid oxygen. So that's a rough idea of what's going on with this. I see we're running out of time here, Dick, but we could discuss this, or could also let you know that Rosetta is going to be landing that spacecraft, the leap on that comet. That would be on the 12th of November. In the afternoon, I got a couple of different times, so I'm not going to give you time, but none of the times match from what I read. Back to you, Dick, for any questions on this or any other topic. This is WS2N.
Good stuff, Paul. Let me ask you this. And those Russian-made, quite old-fashioned engines, it's my belief that before you would put that on a very valuable rocket with very valuable payload, you're going to put that rocket engine on a test stand and confirm that you like the way it works. In theory, that was put on a test stand, and it got the 100%. It got the good housekeeping seal of approval, if you know what I mean. But here's my question: when you're using a rocket engine during a test, is it being slowly consumed? In other words, is there a certain number of hours of thrust you can get out of it before it wears out, so to speak? And so are they between a rock and a hard place to do a thorough enough test to make sure it doesn't have any glitches, but yet not wearing it out? WS2N, KQLIW.
They have to fire these engines, every one of them, before they go up. So they're all tested, shuttle engines and done like that, everything. And just so happened the one back in May blew up. As far as longevity, they all have, you might call them cooling systems. The older ones, have a piping design where pipes run around the chambers and around the bell cone coming off of it. Try to keep it cool that way. And then you have the Russian designs, which we picked up on our new engines. Essentially, a double piece of metal with channel down the middle, and then you've got the cooling fluids going down the, through the channels. It's a lot simpler than designing combustion chambers with pipes all going around it. Too many places for a problem. So, we have changed our design over the years. The Merlin engine being built by SpaceX is the best. High performance, not one has failed. They've built 100 of these things. In fact, he's got a launch coming up. You know, when I say Elon Musk with SpaceX has a launch coming up in December. They're going to launch the International Space Station cargo mission from Florida, and that's going to. They try to make these things reusable.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That, and it'll hit the water and then just fall over. Now this time, on the Atlantic Ocean, he's got a barge about the size of a football field, like 300 feet long and 175 feet wide. And he's going to try to bring down this first stage and land it vertically on that barge. He thinks he's got about 50% chance of doing it, but sooner or later he thinks he's going to do it. And when he does, he's going to take that same first stage and reuse it. That's his goal, to create reusable rockets, first stage, second stage, and including the spacecraft itself, either the cargo or version, which they're flying now. He designed to be reusable, but NASA doesn't want it, or the manned ones, the crewed ones that they'll be flying probably in 2017, which will be reusable, up to 10 different flights. Gonna run out of time, but I wanted to talk about that. I'm trying to rush this. The Virgin Galactic failure. Unfortunately, one guy died, and the other pilot serious injuries. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the Virgin Atlantic, which I think is the Mojave Desert. That was at Mojave Airport, and I've been there. Give us some more on that one. Don't worry about the time, Paul. Guys, copy? Yeah, I heard somebody say, do you guys copy? Do you have a question for the space section of the TechNet? If so, give us your call letters and your name and proceed. K2RIW, space, TechNet, my name is Dick.
K2RIW, hello Dick, my name is Al, W2BUM. So I wanted to make sure I was making the machine. I was listening to the Q-show there, very interested in the space stuff, so I'm reading them out. I just want to make sure I'm making the machine.
You're making the machine, Al, and as soon as Paul finishes, we almost always have a question and answer period, so if you got some further questions, you can probably give them, Al. Go ahead then, proceed. And so I know that people were signing up to go on these missions to space, and now this... this failure at Mojave, I guess it's going to dampen our spirits a little bit. WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, I heard nobody cancel. In fact, one guy signed up good faith. You know, he's got faith in the whole system. But $250,000 to go suborbital. A little steep for me. I mean, for that kind of money, I like to blow me into orbit, you know. By the way, I'm glad we have another space band out there. Lady checked in. The spacecraft has been under like 50 different tests, but this was only the second or third time they lit the rocket on this one, and of course it failed. They take it up on the White Knight. A four-engine carrier craft, and then they drop it at 50,000 feet, and then with one engine, lights spaceship two, and that's supposed to take it up to 62 mile or higher altitude to this way that you can say you make it into space. And the passengers, you would have had six passengers and two pilots for every one of these flights, and Richard Branson has been planning this for years. He had Spaceship One that won the Antares Prize back in 2004, got a $10 million prize for a first rocket to make it to space, and make that same turnaround within a two-week period. And now he's been building the new one they had like a rubber-based fuel, and it wasn't working out. I don't think they were getting the thrust they wanted, for the bigger craft. So they went with a plastic type of fuel, some kind of plastic that burns. And for some reason, maybe that's the problem. We don't know yet. It might take them months to figure this out. Although they had plenty of indicators all over the spacecraft, all test flights, you might have hundreds of different sensors all over. It's not like you're doing a regular flight on you don't have that many pieces of equipment on board to make a detection. If you pick up a black box and just go by that, they have hundreds of sensors and cameras, half a dozen cameras all over the spacecraft, cameras on the white knight that they dropped it, they'll be able to investigate this thing really, to the point where they'll probably figure out what went wrong and try to correct it. But it's going to, without a doubt, put the idea of putting passengers in space on Spaceship Two probably, I'm going to guess, at least a couple of years. He wanted to do it in 2015. Actually wanted to do it this year, but everything kept getting pushed back. But that's not going to happen for a while. And it looks like the other guy that's building the Lynx by X-Tor, a California company, it looks like he's going to win. He's the guy with a set of six passengers. WSN, instead of six passengers, he's going to have the one passenger. He's going to be piloting you. Side by side, not behind one another. It's not going to be like a fighter jet. And then off you go from the ground. No carrier airplane. Take off from the ground, get up to height, and come on back. That's a lot less expensive. It's only $90,000. Back to you, Dick WS.
Yeah, 62 miles is roughly 330,000 feet of altitude. Boy, that's up there a ways. I presume that engine and that new fuel had been tested on a test stand. And once again, the temporary mystery is, how does it work so well on a test stand, and yet in real flight, it behaves differently? Well, the whole flight, from beginning to end, I'm guessing is not a very large amount of time. The actual amount of time you're above 62 miles, I'll bet, is kind of brief. You do get a chance to sense some weightlessness, see the curvature of the Earth, see the blackness of space, and know that you've really been to space. But that kind of money, for that brief an exposure, for that kind of money, you and I would count the number of radio transmitters and radio towers that we could build. buy is what I should have said. And in the case of the radio equipment, let me drop this. You get a chance to use it for the next 10 years and then sell it as used equipment. But to go into space, and the total amount of time you're in space is probably less than 5 minutes. That seems like it's pretty expensive in dollars per hour. There was a question I had, I'm trying to think of right now. So you're predicting that Virgin Atlantic is going to be quite delayed by this particular failure. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, it looked like he was going to be first to get paying passages up, but I don't think so. I think the X-Corps will probably win. Let's hope you don't have any problems. I would not want to go up for, it's about 6 to 8 minutes of weightlessness that you get, the motor burns out and that whole time, so you start coming down again and in the atmosphere, that's all weightless time. And for both crafts, they predict 6 to 8 minutes. I'd rather save my money up for my paper route, instead of paying the $250,000 that Virgin Atlantic wants, and save up $40 million and pay pay to go on the Russian Soyuz rocket. You know, maybe you're going to get a week or so in space, a week to 10 days, possibly, on board the International Space Station. That sounds like fun. But you gotta save up a little bit more, Dick. You know. Next one that's going to be doing that, next private one is Sarah Brightman. That'll be next year. And she's actually a singer. She's been training for this for a while in Star City in Russia. And paying the big bucks to do it. And there's been a half a dozen earlier ones that have done it. They haven't done it lately. Drop it. Keep bringing up three, and then bring it back down three. But it looks like they're going to have open seats now because they're going to start with one-year flights for one American and one Russian. So the Soyuz goes up, you know, they'll only be bringing up two astronauts, to leave room for a paying passenger. Back to you, Dick.
Listen, Mike. It seems like the paying passengers, I know there's another person going to ask a question. The paying passengers, it seems like there were 10 million in the beginning, and now the price has gone to 40 million on Soyuz. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, I think the early flights was there. Who was it? Dennis Tito was the first one to pay. I think he was 20 million. I think they're up to 40 million now. Astronauts from the United States, you think they would get a discount? It's 70 million.
Yes, Mike. Okay, who is that? Got a question? Instead of your name and your call letter, sir. Okay, maybe I'm hearing another repeater. Al, did you have a question? I can't think of Al's call letter. W2PUN, I think it is. T2LAW.
W2PUN. I listen to you guys. Guys are obviously very, very intelligent on this, but I do have a question, yes.
Fire away, Al.
Think they're going to be able to land on the Comet?
Oh, if I understand correctly, I'm going to turn it over to Paul. Are people going to the Comet? No way. The duration is way too long. You can't put enough consumables on there to keep the man alive. But when it comes to the spacecraft we've got that's going to land on the Comet, that's about to happen in the next month or two. Give us some words on that one, Paul. I think they've already chosen the landing location on that Comet 67P, and I think they're going to bore a hole in it to anchor the spacecraft to the comet. And as the comet goes closer to the sun, they're going to ride the donkey right through the hot zone, so to speak, and we're going to get a first-hand, up-close and personal pictures of the way the comet outgasses as it goes closer to the sun. WS2N, K2LIW.
And that's the Rosetta spacecraft. Been following it for quite a few months now. Caught up to it back in January, February. And now you have the lander that's attached to it, the Philippe, and that's going to disconnect the 12th of November. It looks like probably 11:30 Eastern Standard Time. That's the best guess. I got a couple of rough different times. Probably land around 3:30 our time. So that'll be Wednesday, November 12th. And everything Dick said, you know, it's going to harpoon itself to the comet, and then before the harpoons break loose, it's got some kind of motorized auger type of thing. It's going to on the four legs. It's going to pull itself into the comet. And it's going to hang out there for many months, all the way around the sun, like Dick said, all the way back out to Jupiter. And then the mothercraft, Rosetta, will be following it all that time. And this has been a long mission that was launched from French Guiana in 2004 by the European Space Agency. NASA has some experiments on board, so that's how our country's involved. But it was really a big European Space Agency project. Back to you, Dick.
Just have a big Hilti on it, right?
They're gonna launch a rover off a satellite. Do you think it's gonna land proper?
Missing the question. They're gonna launch. Did he say rover? It's not a rover. I missed the question.
Yeah, he wants a little bit more information about the lander of Rosetta. Like you said, it's going to go down to the surface, bore itself in, hang on for the ride as the comet goes closer to the sun. And if it's a typical comet, as it goes closer to the sun, it's going to be doing a whole lot of outgassing and make a comet tail. But we're going to be up close and watching it happen. And right now, I guess the main question I've got, Paul, is the comet itself, is it in a very slow rotation? Because I'll bet you as that comet starts outgassing when it gets closer to the sun, I'll bet you the rotation rate is likely to increase pretty fast. Although, since the comet is connected directly to, since the spacecraft is connected directly to the comet, the rate of rotation doesn't really matter. That just tells you how fast the sun sweeps by the horizon, so to speak. A bunch of guesses on my part, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW.
W2BU1. Okay, that was station. I'm amazed that the spacecraft could orbit this thing anyway. It's shaped like a dumbbell. It's a strange looking comet. The Philippe lander has got about 10 different instruments on board. So does the Rosetta spacecraft. And they have spot figured out, and they have a backup landing space in case they have a problem. So it's going to be on the smaller part of this two-lobe type of comet. It's going to be interesting to see. I don't know. If this thing's going to start spinning, you know. But if it does, it'll be attached to itself. And if it starts spinning, I wonder if they're going to back out the mother craft, you know, keep it away a little bit. I don't know how they're going to do this. But it's all going to be very interesting. First time this has ever happened, that's for sure. Japan has a mission going out to an asteroid, and that's going to be launching next month, maybe the end of this month. So they have a comet return mission called Hayabusa 2. Not a comet return, asteroid return. Trying to get a couple of grams back, they'll be happy if they do that. So a lot of these things are going on. We've done it with stardust, with micro particles back from a comet. All interesting. I'm fascinated about how they get there, how long, you know, what kind of equipment they need to do that. It's amazing. This thing's all solar paneled. Solar panels on the lander. A lot of good engineering has gone into all of these flights. Back to Dick.
Now, Paul, you just speculated that they'll have to back away if the comet starts rotating. I'm not so sure that's required. Your Rosetta is off to one side, I think acting as a repeater to fill up the spacecraft that goes down to the surface and bores itself in. It's going to be making the up-close and personal measurements, photography, and whatever, sends that signal up to Rosetta. Rosetta mails it back to the United States. As the comet outgasses, the chances of it outgassing equally on all sides, so if there's no rotational vector, I think is very slim. There's going to be rotation.
Now, 30 seconds, Dick.
Now, is the rotation going to be once per day, once per hour? These are the things to be discovered. There's going to be rotation. But just because it rotates doesn't mean that the mass center shifts. The mass center is going to stay in the same place. Therefore, the Rosetta in orbit around it, I don't think has to back away. Just sit back there and watch as I see it, Paul. Also, by the way, I've been completely goofed up on timing because my watch is still set on daylight. Well, looks like... Looks like we did get cut off there, Paul, but I'll be able to hear you. So go ahead. You can see what I'm saying, Paul, is that the mass center doesn't shift. So I don't think Rosetta has to back away. It's still going to be watching a tumbling object. the radio communication is going to get a little bit spooky as it tumbles, and each time the Philip is on the backside, so to speak, you're going to get a little bit of a blackout if you don't have a whole lot of extra signal strength. WS2N, K2RAW, Grand Pole. Very, very fine, Paul. Unfortunately, Paul, the signal is not coming through. If you did transmit to 975, 375, we would hear you. So that last transmission, I heard it because I'm listening to you on the input. Other people didn't hear it. Okay, this was TechNet 1528. And more to follow. As you guys can tell, there's an awful lot to radio equipment. I mean, John and I and Paul can name quite a number of very valuable components that to date have not been properly defined, described in the amateur literature. As such, we amateurs are fairly unknowledgeable about an awful lot of components. John and
an error has occurred.
John and I know a few of these other components, and we're going to be describing them. Okay, 73 you all, and John, I'll pass it over to you for any final comments. We intend to be back next week, because we think there's more information. We think there's more that's unknown than known. It's a joke. KC2, WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
By the way, I should have gone over to the other repeater. 73, Dick. 73, John. Good night.
John, you sounded good, Paul. Go ahead, John.
Okay, Dick. I hope you're hearing me. Very good, Ned. A lot of good information. And, Paul, I apologize for being so long and holding you up, but we'll cure that next week. I want to thank everybody for joining us on Echolink, and let's see, mailbag stuff. Good night. So, if everything goes well, we'll see you again next week. KC2WGB. Good night, Dick. Paul? Wes?
Yeah, as you can tell, what happened is we got onto an exciting subject, and we went with the flow. We don't have a really tight schedule. If you're looking for a tight schedule, then you're looking for some other net. Bye-bye, you all. K2RIW clear.
And to HGN. Thank you very much, Dick, John, Paul, Glenn, Eric, and others. And I believe, Dick, you open up the Pandora's box when you start to talk about directional coupler for the first time today, a little bit deeply or deep enough to go to the physical basis of it. Extremely interesting stuff, and I have a lot of interesting questions about it. Anyhow, have a good night.
Yeah, believe it or not, that explanation about the transformer coupling and the capacitive coupling is something that I derived from a bunch of experiments. I haven't read that theory of operation in any of the respected books. So on the assumption I haven't made some big error, you're hearing some very new inside information that hasn't been put into any of the respective books so far. I've got a whole bunch of opinions along those lines about how antennas really work, and I'm slowly working on an article on that subject because the books do not do a good job of explaining it from my point of view. So, in other words, be a little bit careful. There's a slim chance that there's some error in this capacitive coupling and transformer coupling. But the explanation works, and when you do experiments, it seems to confirm that that's the real theory of operation, even though the good books don't explain it that way. Bye-bye, you all. K2RAW.
I agree, Dick. That's where my experiments show that you're absolutely right. Hey, Wes.
Yeah, you could next week say a little bit more about the three main parameters, which would be the impedance, mode impedance, and the electrical length. That would be one thing that I would like to hear a little bit more about: coupling ratio, insertion loss, and insulation and return loss, weak gauge, and also when you have a 3 dB, yeah, you said. that actually when you have a low scalp link, that's the amount of power the transmitter is different than when we have a close coupling whatsoever. So that's a basic thing that I would like to you to say something about it. What else? Yeah, also that puzzling question or subject about this thing is much more physically shorter than the quarter of wavelength of operating frequency of the coupler, but still the coupler keeps their high dividend mostly because of the impedance. But anyhow, thank you very much. John.
The time is 12:08 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Good morning. The time is 12:09 a.m.
KC2WGB, NY2H.
NY2H, KC2WGB. Wow, I was monitoring tonight. Very nice. The clock looks beautiful, and I see you've got the DB rates up there. And it's working extremely well.
Because you have a lure on the top of it, that's why.
So I'm not sure if Eric put the prod in to turn this thing back on at 12:30 or not. So I turned it on again manually. We'll have to ask him. Because he's the guy that does all that stuff. I don't know if you saw the log, you know, board took the vote. They're going to turn it back on at 12:30. So it's official. I made the motion. It passed. But I don't know if it was done, so. I'll have to talk to him, make sure he does it. Otherwise, you know, I can't do it manually every week, so.
Anyway,
all right, well, yeah, it's all working well. You guys carry on. I'll leave it on. Hopefully it won't go off. Catch you later. NY2H.
Thank you very much, Lou. I appreciate this very much. How was your weekend?
Oh, my weekend is good. Yeah, we, had dinner with some friends, and we saw a show. It was very good. Anyway, you guys continue. And talk to you later. NY2H.
Have you been to Marathon?
No. You went to the Marathon?
No, I couldn't. I twist my leg a little bit. Didn't break, but twisted. There would be no way for me to participate in it.
Did Todd? I thought Todd was going to participate, or he has in the past.
John?
Lou, I know Todd planned to be there, but I know he wasn't feeling well last week. Whether he got in shape, I don't know, but I'm sure if he did it, he's probably home exhausted.
Amen, Hanley. All right. You guys continue. I'm going to keep my mouth shut here. Doing a couple things on the computer. Catch you later, NY2H.
Okay, Lou, and thank you again. Very good.
John, what is your recent experiment?
I'm just contemplating the reality of the existence, you know, things like that. That's silly stuff. I was working with my, what are they? I have a bunch of, and now I forgot, the sensors. That's what they are, power sensors that are made by HP and Weichel and a whole bunch of things. And I've been playing with those, working at radar frequencies, and do a few little experiments.
Now, would you be able to take your directional coupler and try to fire it up at a frequency of 15 kilohertz?
Yeah, I probably could, but at 15 kilohertz, I don't think I would see much on the coupled.